Well, I wonder what your Sunday morning typically looks like. Because for me, it's normally a scene of complete chaos. Beck and I get woken up by our toddler, who's 18 months old, and we go into his room and we pick him up out of his cot. And from that point on, to the point where we leave for church, it's complete bedlam. I'll be looking after Micah and trying to get him changed and change his nappy and get him into his clothes, while Beck will be getting ready, and then we'll swap. Beck will look after Micah and she'll be trying to give him his food while I go and get ready. And you know what toddlers are like, they don't really cooperate, do they? You're rushing and they're saying, no, I want to play with my trains. By the time we get him ready and by the time I put the key in the ignition to start the car, I feel like my head has been through a washing machine cycle. Ironically enough, I'm here to talk to you about peace this morning. Now, for those of you who were here last week, do you remember Caleb brought a message from Isaiah 11? And he brought the chair up, remember that? And he said that it's a special chair because it's Mum's chair. Mum sits down, and then pretty soon there's chaos and she has to stand up and restore order to the chaos, and then once there's order and peace, she can go and sit down again. When I read through the Bible, I see a tension between two realities. On one hand, God sits on the throne. We have peace and we have order because God is on the throne. The Almighty Sovereign sits on the throne, his work complete. This is the real reality, if you like. A kingdom that he has established. But on the other hand, I see a reality that this world presents to me. Like my typical Sunday morning, it's a reality of disorder and chaos and instability. When life feels like it's spiraling out of control, it's so hard for me to see this real reality, the real reality of God on his throne and of peace and a kingdom of peace. And I think that's because this peaceful kingdom is a hidden one. It's one that is real, but we can't see it just yet. Paul writes this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, but then I will know fully. It is a present reality, but it's also one that we long to have revealed to us in its completion. Something tangible that we can see right now. And this tension, it's a tension between the real and the less real. It's a tension between the final and the temporary, or the substance and its shadow. It's a tension between the kingdom of God and what we see around us every day. That is what we will be talking about this morning in Isaiah 9. And the question we'll be asking ourselves is this: how do we live in this in-between time? We've been working our way through Advent over the past 3 weeks, you will have noticed. And each Sunday, we've been working our way through Isaiah and looking at what Isaiah's prophecies tell us about this, well, tell us about Christmas, how they point us to Christmas. But did you know that that's not what Advent was actually originally about? Advent, originally, before it became about Christmas, it originally had a dual purpose. Yes, it was looking back on what Christ has done for us through his earthly ministry, but it was also a time of looking forward to Christ's coming on the clouds and bringing his kingdom down to earth. And I think that's why we feel this tension, this tug of war, if you like. Because we're living in between two times. We're living in between Christ's first coming and Christ's second coming. But what do we do when we feel like we're in the waiting room? And what exactly are we waiting for? Well, Isaiah 9 has a lot to say to these questions. But before we jump in, I'd just like to say a word or two about Isaiah's use of imagery. He uses imagery a lot in his poetry. You might have noticed this. He uses an image to explain what something else is like. So it's kind of like when you have a really weird or bizarre dream and you wake up and you turn to your partner and you say, I just had the weirdest dream. And they say, oh, well, what was it about? And you say, well, I can't really describe it. It was too bizarre. And you'll say, oh, it was sort of like this or it was sort of like that. That's using imagery. What Isaiah does, you see, is he sees these images of God, these visions of God, and they are so far outside of normal human experience that he has to use these images just to translate it into something that people will actually be able to understand. So that's what we will be paying special attention to this morning. These images and what they tell us about God and what they tell us about this kingdom of peace. Now, Isaiah 9, verse 1. But there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. Now, if we could just get that first map up, Raj. I think the first thing we need to focus on is where Zebulun and Naphtali actually is, where it was situated. So it's right up there in the northern part of the northern kingdom. You can see the two arrows pointing to them. Now there's a few things we need to know about this area in Isaiah's time. You see, Assyria was becoming a dominant world superpower. Politically and militarily, they were expanding their influence. And they were starting to expand, see where it says Hittites and Arameans, they were starting to expand into this territory, taking over by force as they went. Now, Israel was a vassal state, which meant that they had to pay tributes to the Assyrian king. Now, can you imagine what it would have been like for the people of Zebulun and Naphtali to live with Assyria right on their doorstep? You would have been terrified, right? It would be like if you guys were alive when World War II broke out and you were right on the doorstep of Germany. So it's a place of fear. And when Assyria decided to attack, they attacked from the north, and guess where they swept through first? If we can have the next slide up, Raj. Yep, right through Zebulun and Naphtali, of course. They had their heads on the chopping block right from the start. So Zebulun and Naphtali were exposed to the ravages of war and all of the horror and the evil and the fear that's associated with that, and all the darkness. So that's the first thing to note. The second thing to note is that this was a highly Gentile region, which is why Isaiah calls it Galilee of the nations. In another translation, it says Galilee of the Gentiles. Okay, so this was a multicultural, multi-religious melting pot. So from a Jewish person's perspective, it was a spiritually dark place. So that's the background, if you like. A spiritually dark place, war-torn, ravaged, and with a confused identity. I guess what I'm trying to point out is that this was definitely not a peaceful place to live. Not by any stretch of the imagination. However, God is going to do something for these people who have been walking and living in darkness. God is about to do something that will bring about a change from anguish and gloom to a glorious restoration and joy. Verse 2 picks up on this theme. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in the land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. Now this is our first image. It's one of contrast between light on one hand and darkness on the other. And in the Bible, light normally symbolizes God's presence or spiritual illumination or salvation or faith. It normally represents all that is good and pure and right. But as we will see, this light also represents a coming kingdom. And it is Galilee of all places, the most heathen place in Israel, the most spiritually dark, the most likely to experience the atrocity of war. Galilee is where God is going to shine his light and start to bring about peace. We learn something of God's character from this, and it's an astonishing insight. God's light goes to the people who are most in need of his grace, but who are least deserving of it. It's amazing grace on display. He doesn't honour the people who have it all together or who think they have it all together, and he doesn't honour the high and mighty. Notice also that Isaiah is able to write in the present tense, even though he's clearly speaking about a time which is yet to come. He continues speaking in the present tense in verse 3. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. Isaiah writes here, you have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you now, not you will do this in 700 years' time. We begin to see here this tension between the now and the not yet. Because Isaiah's message is one of present reality alongside a future hope. Now, bearing this in mind, we're going to have a look at the images that we get here in verse 3. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest. Now, this first part, joy at the harvest, this holds a special place in my heart. I used to work in vineyards, worked in the wine industry for quite a long time, and I can tell you a little bit about what harvest is like. While you're actually working in the harvest, it's quite difficult because you're working very long hours and it's tough work. It's normally in January or February or March, so it's the hottest part of the year. You have flies buzzing around your head and it's just awful. Not only that, you're working long hours and it's grueling work. You're carrying these buckets of grapes to the tractor and you're putting them in to the back of the tractor and then you're going back for more and you're doing that constantly all day. So when harvest is over, you rejoice because the hard work is finished. The hard, grueling, sweaty work was over. But once harvest was over, we also had a different sort of joy. It was the joy not just in resting now that the hard work had been finished, but an expectant joy in what was yet to come. The joy of what our work and our labours have accomplished. Plus, there was also a vintage feast, which helped, I think. Do you remember a few weeks back, Chris was preaching from Isaiah 24 and 25, and she spoke about the feast that God is going to prepare for his people in heaven. So the image that I get is one of twofold joy. On one hand, after the hard labor of vintage, there is rest. And on the other hand, the best is yet to come. There is feasting and celebrating. Isaiah here gives the image of people standing before their Creator, peaceful, exulting that the toil is over and that the best is yet to come. Now, the second image we get, they rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. Now, when historically did people plunder? It was normally after a war, wasn't it? Yeah, after a battle. The winning soldiers, the soldiers of the winning side, the ones that were left alive, they got to plunder their victims, basically. Now, I just want to put you in the shoes of a soldier. Imagine you're at the start of a battle. It hasn't happened yet. You're on the front line, and the enemy is just across from you. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? Fair amount of trepidation and fear, I'm guessing. You'd be thinking, was that the last meal I ever got to eat? Or was that the last time that I'll ever see my family? Now, fast forward with me in your minds. You're at the end of the battle. Your side has won, and you're one of the soldiers who has escaped death, and now you're partaking in the looting. Now, you have gone from the potential of being killed. Now, you are able to plunder the enemy's loot. So again, we have this twofold, this image of twofold joy. The battle is over, relief that you haven't been killed, but also on the other hand, you get the victory spoils. Now, what do these images tell us? They tell us a little bit about what the kingdom of heaven is like. The kingdom of heaven is complete peace for the people who rejoice in the Lord and who wait expectantly for the Lord. Just like the vineyard worker whose hard work is finished and is looking forward to the rest and the peace and the joy. Just like the soldier who not only escapes pain and death, but also has the spoils of victory. That is what it is like for those who wait on the Lord. It's interesting, Isaiah is still speaking as though this has already happened. And it has, because to those who have faith, it's as good as done. It might as well be a reality, because it is. You know, I'm at the start of my life. I'm only 31. But I find myself longing for the day when I cross the finish line to be in God's arms. Remember last week, Caleb was speaking about the Father's chair and climbing up into the Father's chair and feeling his embrace. However, I'm only now starting to realize that this isn't just something to be looked forward to. This peace and this rest and this joy is something that is available right now. It is for me both an increasing reality right now, and I say increasing because I haven't learnt the lesson fully just yet. But it is an increasing reality, and it is also a hope that I look forward to on that day when the peace and rest and joy will appear in a much fuller reality to what we could ever experience right now. Now, verse 4 begins to explain why it is that we will experience this peace and joy. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. Now, the images that we get here, the yoke, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of the oppressor, they all say the same thing. They all say affliction, pain, and bondage. But God has broken. The image here is of full destruction, of pain and affliction. But the key to understanding this verse is right at the end. You have broken as on the day of Midian. Now this goes back to Judges 6 and 7. The Midianites had been oppressing Israel, and they'd been oppressing them for 7 years. And then finally, they cried out to God, and God heard them, and he said, "Okay, I'll deliver them." And so he raises up Gideon. Do you remember Gideon? Gideon with his fleece, and he tests God. Is it from God? Isn't it from God? Anyway, Gideon starts off with 33,000 men. And God says, no, that's too many men. Because if that army of 33,000 men gets victory, then they'll take the credit for it. There's too many of them. And so he says, anyone who's afraid can go home. And so 11,000 of them go home, and they're left with 22,000, as you would. God decides it's still too many warriors. They're still going to take the credit for it. So he sends the men down to the water, where he says, anyone who gets down on their hands and knees and laps the water like a dog can stay, and all who bring the water up like this, they have to leave. And he ends up with 300 men left. Goes from 33,000 to 300. It's a terrible strategy. You don't win wars like this normally, do you? Normally it's strength in numbers. To make matters worse, Gideon arms the men, not with swords, not with bow and arrow, like you typically expect. He arms them with trumpets, empty jars, and with torches inside the jars. Right now he's got more of a travelling band than an army. But as they attack, and you have to picture this, it's the middle of the night, probably 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning, and they sweep down into the Midianite camp. They smash the jars all at once, so there's this tremendous noise, they start blowing on the trumpets, and they start waving these torches around. So there'd be light and noise all of a sudden, and God confuses the Midianites, and they turn on one another, and they destroy one another. Whose victory was it? The Lord has broken as on the day of Midian. You see, what this means is that God has done this on our behalf. This peaceful kingdom that he is bringing about, God has done this for his people. It's God's work. Verse 5 picks up on the theme of the Midianites and their armies. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all of the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. You see, when the Midianites came through the land, they'd bring so many men and so many camels that they looked like locusts going through a field. And what they didn't eat, they would trample underfoot anyway. And so the image that we get is one of complete devastation of the crops and the harvest and the land. But all the boots, all the blood-soaked garments, all of the things that signify violence and destruction will be thrown into the fire. The image that we get is the total destruction of the things that destroy. When Caleb was preaching last week from Isaiah 11, there was a verse that really stood out to me. Isaiah 11, verse 9. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It's a kingdom of peace. It's a kingdom where death and destruction are done away with for good. And in verses 6 and 7, we come to the culmination of our passage, as Isaiah tells us how it is that death is put to death. For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Now, Beck and I have recently finished watching a TV series called The Crown. Has anyone watched The Crown? A few of you. It's a Netflix series. And for those of you who haven't watched it or who haven't heard about it, it's about the royal family. The British royal family, that is, and the Queen of England. Now, there's this one scene that really stood out to me. And the Prime Minister of England, of Great Britain at the time, is meeting with the Queen. They have these weekly meetings, you see. Anyway, he meets with her and he's chastising her, very gently, of course, and very tentatively. But he's chastising her because he doesn't think that she's inspiring her people. She's not doing enough for them. The Queen of England turns to him and says, "Well, what do they want from me?" And he says, "Well, they want you to be ideal. They want you to be perfect." And she says, quite understandably, "Well, no one's perfect." And she's right. Except being ideal and perfect is exactly what's described of this son. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His person is perfect, and his reign in his kingdom is characterized by perfect peace. This is a kingdom where the people who call him king will enjoy the peace and prosperity of the perfectly peaceful kingdom. If anyone wants to know about human kings, then I suggest reading through 1 and 2 Kings in your Old Testament. Usually the king was terrible, but sometimes you'd get a good king. And so, you know, so-and-so did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and he brought the people into peace, or God gave the land peace. But then he died, and he gave the kingdom and the crown and the throne to another person. And usually that person was less competent, and usually they didn't do what was right in the eyes of the Lord. The king described here in Isaiah 9 won't die and leave the crown and the responsibility to another less competent person, because this king will reign forever. Can you see the difference between the eternal and perfect king described here and the failings of human leaders? They just can't bring about peace, can they? This one can, and this one will. He will be given full authority to do whatever he wishes, but he will act with righteousness and justice, a righteousness and justice that will bring about peace for all of eternity for the people of God. He will do for all of eternity what no human king or queen thus far has ever been able to do. Now I'd like you to turn with me to your New Testament, to Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 to 17, because I'm sure you're all anxious to find out who this king is. Now when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time Jesus began to proclaim, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." There's two things that we learn from this Matthew passage. The first thing is Matthew clearly believes that Jesus of Nazareth is the one who is the king described in Isaiah 9. Second thing, the kingdom that Jesus says has come near in verse 17 there of Matthew 4 is the kingdom of Isaiah 9. The kingdom that Jesus is in the process of building right now and ushering in and will one day be brought into the light so that all will be able to see. It's a kingdom of peace, a kingdom of joy, a kingdom that will wipe all other kingdoms away. A kingdom that will destroy death and bring an end to war. A kingdom where righteousness and justice are the cornerstones. A kingdom where no one will hurt anyone or be hurt by anything. A kingdom of light where once there was darkness. A kingdom of right relationship with God where once there was only rebellion and sin. A kingdom of eternal rest and peace where the people who wait expectantly for Christ's return will enjoy the happiness of the vineyard worker whose work is finished and who is looking forward to the best which is yet to come, where they will experience the reward of the soldier who has stood firm to the very end. All of the promises of Isaiah 9, this kingdom and the king who will be born, all of these promises are fulfilled in the person of Christ. Now, before I wrap it up, remember right at the start when we spoke about that tension, that tug of war? The tension that between what we can see and what we cannot see? How do we reconcile what we've just learned with the questions that we asked at the start? How do we deal with the lingering tension in our lives between the now and the not yet? Because Christ, here in Matthew, says that the kingdom has already drawn near, and that was some 2,000 years ago. Isaiah uses language that strongly suggests that this has already, in one sense at least, come to pass. Well, I would suggest this. This kingdom is something that God, through Christ, began to usher in around 2,000 years ago. It is also something that is happening right now through the Spirit in the lives of each and every person who confesses that Christ is King. And it is something that we look forward to with eager expectation on that day when God ushers in his perfect and peaceful kingdom with Christ as King at the end of days. A kingdom of peace that is as real, even though we can't see it yet. A kingdom that we are all a part of, yes, even now. That is what Advent is about. Look back on the peace that was bought for you through Jesus' life and his earthly ministry. Look forward to the peaceful kingdom that will one great day be ushered in. But in the meantime, rest in the peace that's already been achieved on your behalf. Father, I thank you that you are a God of rest and peace, and that all who come to you will find rest and peace, both now and from this time onwards and forevermore. Thank you for doing this for us. Amen.